Well, yeah, the guy we're all here really, really here to hear is probably somebody who doesn't require much of an introduction, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. Josh Taylor is the president of the New York Genealogical and Biographical Society. He's a past president of the Federation of Genealogical Societies and has been featured, a future genealogist on Who Do You Think You Are, and is currently one of the hosts on the popular PBS series Genealogy Roadshow. So he is here to talk to us today about finding your potential, which the handout information is on pages 2 and 4. So I give you and greet Josh Taylor. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. It's a fun day. I don't get to spend a day among society leaders that often, so it's wonderful to be here. For lunch, we'll try and talk about some ideas that might shock you. They might not be something that you ever thought you would hear. You might consider them blasphemy from a genealogical society. But the idea is to take a look at our organization, not through our own eyes, but through the eyes of those who might be potential members, potential leaders, and most importantly, for many of us, potential funders and potential donors, because our organizations cannot live on membership dues alone. For most of our organizations, we know that membership dues don't actually equal the amount of money it takes to support all of your activities. We'd like it to equal out, but it doesn't. There's other elements that we need to consider as part of our societies. So as we sort of talked this morning, a few of our societies look something like this. Some of them look very good on the outside, right? I'm currently house hunting right now, and I'm experiencing all of this fun thing of it looks beautiful on the outside, and then you go inside, and it's just not quite what you were picturing. And if you were to take a picture of the elements and some of the events that a society might do, to some, to particularly those millennials who we're talking about this morning, it might seem very, very different, right? It's not exactly the most engaging thing for them. They don't necessarily want to go to a five-hour workshop or come listen to me all day talk about genealogy. But yet, when you look at family history as it's portrayed on TV, it's one big giant party, right? How is it that Ancestry has millions of customers that all test DNA, and how is it that there's all these people that are being involved in genealogy and family history? But where are they? Why aren't they at our society meetings? Why aren't they involved in our groups? Why aren't they talking to us? Why aren't we working with them? And so as we look at seizing our potential, as we learn to work together, this is not the problem of the Dallas Genealogical Society or a county genealogical society or a town historical society. This is every genealogical society's problem. This is a united issue. I can't think of a single genealogical society that does not have a problem like this, where the world of family history as presented sort of in mass media does not equal the world of our societies. The fact is we should have societies in major metropolitan areas that have thousands of members, and we should have societies in smaller rural areas that have hundreds, even not thousands of members, because of how popular genealogy and family history is. So right now, I want you to just promise me you will do this on your very first instinct. I'm going to ask you to describe your society in a single word, and I want you just out loud to say what that word is. Go. Wow, okay, one more time, a little louder. One word. Stagnant, dying, surviving. Interesting. Okay, so I've done this in a couple of instances, and I don't want to depress anyone here. That's not our goal, right? We're here to inspire and work together. But boy, that seems to be some common themes in there, right? If we're surviving, that's great. Some of us are dying, some of us are stagnant. Sometimes we think of it as work, because we are the leaders of the societies, and the society for us is work. Sometimes it's fun, right? It's actually fun for us to get together. Someone might think very, very easily as genealogy. We heard words like dying and failing. Did anyone think of something that was successful, vibrant, active, alive? What about stuck in a rut? Right, we're doing the same thing we've always done. We do it really, really well, but we're doing it to fewer and fewer people. What if you asked that question to the nearest non-genealogist in your life? How would they describe your society? Right, to me, it would be, boring. It would be, probably time, because it just takes your time. What about a brand new member to your society? What is their very first experience? We just talked about how, you know, people come in and how they're greeted, how they're perceived from that very, very first moment. But how would a brand new member describe your society? These are your ambassadors. This is your army, right? These are folks that can help recruit new members and that can keep your society alive. What would they use to describe your society?
Curious.
Curious. Maybe they're excited. Maybe they're ready. What about the former members? Do we ever think about the perception we've left in their mouths when they no longer send in their membership check? Because even though they're no longer your members, they're still your customers, in a way, and they absolutely have a role in the perception that your society will be given when it's shared with other individuals. What about your current members, your current core group of members who have supported you through thick and thin, who send in their check without even thinking about it? What word do they use to describe your society? Is it fun? Is it something that they do?
Loyal.
Loyal. They might feel themselves very, very loyal. Do they feel like they're a part of something? What about your local mayor? Do they even know about your society? Have you introduced yourselves? Have you presented their family history and said, this is what we do, by the way? Or have you given them a DNA kit and said, we'd love to talk about how you can use this to sort of find common connections? Have you presented your own organization to your local leaders? What about your local convention and visitors bureau? Right, this is a place that's going to field queries from visitors and businesses and those that are interested in your local community. What would they say about your society? They might not know that it even exists. Again, have we done the outreach? Have we presented ourselves to groups that don't necessarily find us online because they're not looking for us? Ancestry makes millions of dollars by marketing to people by creating the urgency and the excitement over family history. We might not have millions of dollars to spend, but there's a lot of excitement and energy around family history that we can absolutely present. So, to be very, very honest, there's a huge disconnect. How in the world can family history be literally one of the most popular hobbies in the United States? How can it have not one, not two, but three major TV shows? How can there be three companies, soon to be four, five, and six companies, that make millions, if not billions of dollars off of DNA testing, when you compare that to our societies? Declining members, limited funds, an inability to try new things, right? How many of you, if you had $1 million for your society, do you know how you'd spend it? What about $100,000 or $5,000 or $1,000? How would you spend it? What would you do with it? Or would you be stuck in a quandary of a treasurer that insists on keeping it because you never know when you're going to need it? A board member that wants to spend it right away because we have to do something new, because it has to be the new shiny thing. And a board that remains deadlocked because they have no plan for growth. They have no plan to do something more than what they are. So the world of family history to some is a world of fun and excitement. To others, it looks something like this. And this is where we have the disconnect. So when we look at finding our potential and collaborating with one another in 2017, I think one of our greatest potentials lies in the fact that we all share this common problem. Every society I know, every single one of those societies that I've talked to, that I'm a member of, that I've visited, that I've read about on Facebook, that I've heard about from friends, has this common theme. So we always know that we need fresh ideas. I don't know any society that has too many volunteers. We always need new members. We always need more money. And we also need a new outlook on our society. So here's where I sort of say there's some potentially radical ideas ahead. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with doing all of these things. I'm saying that I want to get us thinking about them. Because sometimes it's good to play devil's advocate on a situation and see, well, why do you do certain things that you do? Or why do we think that's actually going to be successful? What if your society was an entirely digital organization? What if you never had a personal human connection with another member of your society? What if it was all online? What would you gain? What would you lose? Right? You might lose one of the best assets to your society, which is that smiling face and that actual person. At the same time, how many of your members never ever meet your organization because they don't live in your local area? How do you serve them? Are you just grateful they renew? What if your society were to merge with another local organization? Would you lose your identity? What could you do together rather than apart? You know, a sort of bank account with $5,000 in it plus a bank account with $15,000 gives $20,000 for an organization potentially to do something very, very unique. What if you worked to raise funds together for a project rather than on your own? What if your next publication you're working on, your next project, was a joint project? Because you both recognize that you're basically going to the same customer base over and over and over again. What if you stopped doing your annual seminar? What would happen? Would you lose members because that's the only thing they come for? Would you gain members because you now had volunteers that spend 6 months of their lives preparing the world's best seminar? What else could they do? What if you just didn't do it for a year? What if you did it every 18 months or every 7 months? What if you cut the board in half? Not literally. But what if you literally said, from an organizational standpoint, there are too many chefs in this kitchen. We are going to cut the number of board members in half because we can't fill the seats. Our meetings are too contentious. Nothing is getting done because it's either the president or the board that makes a decision. What if you look at the leadership of your organization and said, we need more leaders, but we don't necessarily need a larger quantity. We need more leadership collectively. What if you remove the word society from your name? What would you be? Well, what are you? What are you if you're not the Dallas Genealogical Society or the Fort Worth Genealogical and Historical Organization? I work for a society. Just this morning I was asked, well, what does the New York Genealogical and Biographical Society do? It's a very long name. You're right. It's a very, very long name. It says what we do, but it also doesn't say what we do. Because in the year 2017, the New York Genealogical and Biographical Society, or the G&B as we affectionately call it, tells New York stories. That's what we do. But so many people can't get past the name that they don't actually listen to the message of what you do. Now, I'm not suggesting that every single organization in here abolish the word society and change their name. That's not the intention. But I want you to think about how often you see millennials and those, let's say, even under the age of 45, joining and being involved with a society and paying to do so. We don't pay to be on Facebook. We don't pay to be on Twitter. Why would I join a society? What is a society? So how do you present your society, if that's your name? And I absolutely know that it's very unlikely anyone in here would go back to their board and say, we're going to change our name, because I know how those things go. But what if we spent more time working together as societies, as organizations, as groups, rather than working apart? Because again, we share these collective problems. What if we started campaigns together that help provide information about what a genealogical society is and what they can do to our local mayors, to our local CVBs, to our local businesses? What if we worked for a grant together collectively that brought in $500,000 to support local preservation? That was distributed to local genealogical societies that were part of an alliance that worked together to form a grant. Because not every society can have the skill sets to form a grant proposal and to win that proposal and to moderate that proposal over time. But collectively, think of what you could do. But before you do any of this, you have to know what your society and you bring to the table. Who are you? And most importantly, what is your USP, your unique selling point? What is the thing that you do better than anybody else? I'm always fascinated when I sit down with people, we talk about raising money or working on projects, and they ask, well, what do you love about your job? And I say, because I have the best unique selling point ever. It doesn't matter whether the person in front of me is African-American, whether they're American Indian, whether they're from China, whether they're from Korea, whether they're from Iraq, from Africa, they have a story. It doesn't matter whether the businessman in front of me has $1 million to give me or a dollar to give me. They have a story. It is all in the perception that we give of what our organization can do. So a couple of thoughts on branding from some leaders that look at branding. Branding is first and foremost about perceptions. Your nonprofit has a brand whether or not you have a fancy logo, a snappy tagline, or a style guide. In every interaction, you're shaping perceptions deliberately or accidentally. Which means that when you walked in today, you gave everyone in this room, everyone at your table, me, everyone, the perception and the brand of your society. I made a judgment call about how successful you were as an organization, what you actually could offer as an organization. You are a representative of your society everywhere you go, whether or not you know what you're saying, you're giving off your society's brand. I'd rather have a board united behind a brand when they visit places to talk about the organization. Here's another thought. Although many nonprofits continue to take a narrow approach to brand management, using it as a tool for fundraising, a growing number are moving beyond that approach to explore the wider strategic roles that brands can play, driving broad, long-term social goals while strengthening internal identity, cohesion, and capacity. That would be a dream for most of our societies. A board that was set on one mission that was more than just make sure we don't go under and add new members. What if your board and your organization knew the value that it brought a local society and a local institution? What if your board could do more because you're actually doing less? Right? Our three goals this year, the support our mission, are 1, 2, 3, and that's what we're focusing on. One more quote about branding. Creating a strong brand is long, hard work. It is more subtle of a process than merely creating a new logo or a tagline. I absolutely agree with the comments this morning. A logo is essential because it's what someone sees. I would also add that the important ingredient on top of the logo is how it's used and what someone says about the logo when they see it. If your logo says, "Great organization for a mature audience that's going to hold their meetings that I can't attend." Logos say all of that. But if your logo also is a party logo that someone is going to look at and say, 20-year-olds that do nothing, that don't care about preservation, I'm not going to join, that could also be a bad thing. But it's long, hard work. It's developing a common message for your organization. The branding of your organization really is everywhere. It's in how you do your events. It's in how you do your publications. It's in how your board interacts. It's especially in your social media. It's in your attitude about the organization. But it is absolutely everywhere. You might not think the role that branding plays when the newsletter that you produce compared to the person that puts on an annual meeting, but they all speak to the brand of the organization. And it's more than just a common logo. What are you doing as the organization? Who are you? What's your mission? I, as a kid, I had a fascination with Campbell's soup. Because everywhere I went, there was always the grocery store, and it was full of all of this Campbell's soup. And I thought to myself, how many possible types of soup can there be in the world? Now, sometimes they get a little bit interesting with their brand, right? The Campbell's chunky chicken corn chowder. I don't like chicken corn chowder because there's chicken soup and there's corn chowder. There's not chicken corn chowder that's chunky. They're basically just selling multiple things to me at once. Sometimes the labels don't always reach the package. So the label here of cream of mushroom, those are the corniest mushrooms I have ever seen in my life. And I remember as a child once, I'm obsessed with labeling things. I love labeling things. I'm a librarian, right? I love labeling things. And I took the labels off of all the soup cans because I wanted to relabel them. And my mother was furious with me, right? Because, you know, we played, you know, canned soup roulette for the next year of our lives. Just opened up a can and saw what was inside. Our societies look a lot like these unlabeled soup cans. We know what we are. We might stick a logo on there. But what value do we really bring to our members and to our local communities? Who are we in their eyes, in the face of a crazy popular DNA world? Who are we? How do we fit in? The most exciting part for me is that societies control the labels on your soup can. You get to put whatever you want to on that can. And you can sell that and market that and raise money off of that and work with other people off of that. You can control what's on your soup can. Your soup can is your website, it's your publications, it's your social media, it's your events, it is everywhere. So your soup can could very well have something that says program and events. That's what we do, that's what we're good at, that's how we help. What if it's publications and books? We are known for peer-reviewed publications, we're known for scholarly works. What if you do the best cemetery tours in the world? And so you are known for cemetery tours. What if you simply are the best seminar you'll ever attend? And that's what your organization works for. What about a label that is the board that gets nothing done? The publication you'll never read. That looks great, but your members might not ever read it unless it has an article about their ancestor. Well, has your organization spent time explaining the importance of the publication and what someone can learn from the publication, even if they don't have an ancestor in it? Are you the citation police? Do you insist that every meeting talks about methodology and analysis and citations? Let me tell you, I love footnotes. I absolutely love footnotes. But I very rarely would ever bring them into a general society meeting. Why? Because while that is a strength of an organization, that's not the type of soup they want. That's chunky chicken corn chowder, corn chicken chowder. Are you known for coffee and conversation? Are you a brilliant place to get together? Are you a gathering point? Are you a human connection in the face of technology? Or are you simply here because we always have been? And if none of our members die this year, we still will be. Are you online explorers? Do you help demystify Ancestry.com? Are you record preservers? Do you save records that could be destroyed through natural disasters or through human negligence? Are you people and connections? I would argue very, very strongly for your organizations to think about the role that you play in this sphere of people and connections. We sometimes overcomplicate the missions of our societies because we're trying to figure out what it is that we do that's going to attract someone. Well, maybe if we just add in a courthouse trip or we add in a cemetery tour. That's specific and that's great, but take the 10,000 foot level. What do you do as an organization? We're about people. We're about connections. I love the few times I heard this morning where people said, well, we help people. We're an educational resource. And you know that you are the best suited organizations to possibly do that? Because you can tell me not only how to research in a cemetery, you can tell me where the cemetery is that my great-great-grandfather was buried. You can introduce me to a cousin that I've never met before. Via Facebook, you can probably tell me how to get to the cemetery. You can recommend what hotel to stay at, and you can probably give me the perfect place to have lunch afterwards. That is a product. That is the type of experience that makes someone pay for your society. So a couple of radical ideas still. Have you ever asked non-members and non-genealogists of your society what they want? Have you asked those in your community via a local newspaper or social media or a variety of different methods how we can help? Have you stepped outside of your normal venue, your normal event style, your normal speakers, your normal topics? Have you hosted a topic that might not be necessarily kosher, what you might think it was? What about partnering with a local craft brewery house for a night that celebrates the heritage of that company and the community? Well, what do you mean partner? What would we do? Have 15% of everything they make that night go to your society. and be there to give people 15-minute consultations on how to get started in their genealogy. Or give everyone in there a free 3-month membership to your society. Get them started. That's different than an annual seminar. But I'll guarantee you'll meet people that will never see your flyer in the local library. They'll probably never see it in their public library. But they might very well interact with your society at a later date. This moves far beyond your mission statement, right? Your mission statement is a great lofty goal, and we should have unified short mission statements. But how would you describe your society if you had to avoid using the word society, using the word seminar, the word conference, the word membership, the word meeting, even the word genealogy itself? How would you describe your organization to someone else? We explore the past. We help you connect to the past, present, and the future. These are exciting action words that are understandable by someone that doesn't know what a citation is and doesn't really care what a census is until they do. Because you're talking to people that don't understand how excited you get about tax records. They don't get that. But you do. Can you use words that describe your society as fun, as something that has connections, as something full of great people, that is interactive, and that is an experience? The way that we do genealogy, very few of us can do it completely in a vacuum, right? We have to interact with someone. That's what your society's helped you do. What if you shift your focus, and rather than adding members, you're working to add supporters of your organization? Now, I know membership usually equals dollars. Let me tell you, supporters can sometimes equal bigger dollars. Because supporters equal ambassadors, supporters equal goodwill, and supporters are those that will give you an extra $20 at the end of the year because they support your organization. So a supporter can provide financial support, a supporter can be a connector between others. A supporter gives a positive referral in multiple settings, and a supporter cares about your organization. A society I was affiliated with for a while, I had a program because they was in a very, very touristy neighborhood. And so they did the genealogy of all of the hotel concierges, right? They brought in every single person behind that desk and they did their family history. And guess what that guest was recommended to do when they said, what should we do for the afternoon? Go to this library and talk to the society. Here, it's a free day pass you get from our organization. When I worked at NEHGS, we worked with the operators of the duck boat tours that used to come by. And so every time they stopped in front of the stoplight, they would talk about the building here and what you can find inside and talk about the organization. Those are supporters of the organization that weren't members themselves, that never actually gave a dime to any of the organization's projects. But they were responsible for a lot of members and a lot of income for the organization because they served as active voices, very, very positive referrals to the organizations. Supporters equals donors, supporters equals advocates. And what if you were to throw out everything you currently do as a society? Throw out everything. Your board meeting, your publications, your tours, your seminars, your projects, throw it all out. And choose just 3 things to do. Now, this is where I say that this is not going to happen in real life, right? We're here, we're talking in theoretical terms. But what if you threw out everything you do and had to only choose 3 things to focus on? Things that generated revenue, that kept your lights on, your publications going, something that fulfilled your missions, and things that were actually practical for you to obtain. If your society is near the brink, where you're not sure how much long you're going to be around, I would strongly encourage you to take a list, write down everything you do, and start throwing the things out that don't meet these 3 needs. Because it's crisis time, and it's time to pay attention to what really, really matters. Even if your society is incredibly successful, this is a good exercise every couple of years to do with your board, because it helps you know when to prioritize things and helps you seize new opportunities. Successful societies have no shortage of ideas, but they know how to prioritize between idea 1, 2, or 3. They don't try and do everything at once. So it's time for you to start strutting your stuff. Think of your society as a runway model at a fashion show. And introduce your society and what you can do to local influencers, local politicians, local businesses, local media, local partners, local donors. When I look at local societies, I wish every society would do the family history of any politician that runs during primary season, because I want to get them then before they're building up their campaign. And it doesn't have to be a lot, but I want to introduce myself to them. Local business owners, absolutely. Local editors, local columnists for newspapers, absolutely. We'll have a conversation, sit down for coffee. I've done genealogy of secretaries and administrative professionals just to get to their boss, because that's what you have to do. Something that we have to remember is that we don't just do genealogy, even though many of us are genealogical societies. We preserve local stories, we share stories, and we basically deliver adventures. We also connect generations, and this is such an important point. When you are working in a community and you're working to try and figure out how can we bridge gaps between different ideas and different lifestyles, genealogy has a unique selling point in that it connects people across diverse backgrounds. That's a huge selling point for your organization, especially to someone that's not going to research their entire family tree. Milton Berle has one of my favorite quotes in the entire world. If opportunity doesn't knock, build a door. And I love that because I feel like society so often, we're waiting for the perfect opportunity to come. Right? We're waiting for the thing to enter in that, oh, we can do that. Or we're waiting for the 10 new members to come in. We're waiting for the perfect speaker, waiting for the perfect event. We should build it ourselves. So your soup can isn't actually just your county genealogical society. It is Samuel Lindsay's story presented by your local genealogical society. See, in this whole situation, you're not cream of mushroom, you're not chicken noodle, you're all Campbell's. You can fashion that soup can any way you want. Let your society be the brand and the activities you do, those incredible projects. So when I'm sort of trying to attract someone new to a family history organization, there's a couple of things that I do. And these are very, very simple because you have to do these for a lot of people. So here's how to attract the non-genealogist to make them learn about who you are. The first thing you do is you give them a touch point to the past. Typically, the 1940 census works very, very well for this. It's someone they knew themselves, sometimes it's themselves, or sometimes it's someone they at least have a memory of. So hand in the 1940 census. Then you go one step beyond that touch point to someone they didn't know who is connected to the person they knew. That can be the 1900 census, right? It is literally just a step back. So you're giving them a touch point, one step beyond that touch point. Then give them something that shows that it's more than a document, that shows something about that person's life and their work. City directories and newspapers work wonderfully for this. Here they're on the city directory. Here's their address and here's their occupation. So after you've given them the touch point, one step beyond life and work, you throw in something fun. I call this the food and fun category. I find the closest restaurant to where that person lived, and I give them the ad for the restaurant. Because it's more than just a strict name, date, genealogy. I give them something that's fun, something for them to connect to. And then, and this is always my favorite part, because you know they usually love the person they've connected to. They're fascinated by what can be discovered. They like the food part. Then you pull out the heart and you give them the personal touch. I have probably shown more World War I draft cards than I care to admit. Why? Because of the signature at the bottom. The power of someone who has no idea what genealogy is, who will never ever see this unless you thrust it upon them, the power of seeing that signature for many people is overwhelming. And if it's not, it's time to step back and work maybe towards something else. But the power of that signature, that document that we find time and time again, that's how you get your mayor, your local commissioners, your local newspaper editor, that's how you get them to remember who you are and remember what you can do. It's 5 documents. It literally should take less than 10 minutes to present. It can be the end of coffee, the end of drinks, the end of dinner. It could even be presented online. It could be presented digitally as a portfolio that you hand them. You don't have to be there in person, though it's great if you're there in person. Give them their 5-minute story and introduce yourselves and your organization for what you can do. It's a touch point to the past. It's going beyond that point, life and work, food and fun, and then again, that personal touch, that signature works really, really well. Or give them a DNA kit and say, here is our gift to you. We're having a seminar in 3 months on how to use DNA in your family history. Keep that in mind. And when they talk to people who talk to people who talk about those commercials, they'll at least know where they can go to find the answers. If you've given them the DNA kit, or you've given them sort of that 5 steps, make it their story and make sure you connect it to something more. Introduce your organization, because again, this is your introduction. You don't have to introduce yourself as Cream of Tomato Soup. Right? This is, if your mayor's name was Samuel Lindsay, this is Samuel Lindsay's story brought to you by this Genealogical Society. This is what we do. This is what our members do. This is what they work on time and time again. Make sure that if they come to a meeting, or they get people to come to a meeting, it's not like this, it's something like this. And this is where realizing the strength of your current members can be very, very important. There is an energy among most of your membership that we haven't yet tapped into. If there is any way to get genealogists riled up, restrict access to their records. We don't like that at all. Take that same energy, that same excitement, and instill it in your long-term members, those that love your organization, and keep reminding them and remembering with them why they're there and what your society can bring them. So again, I whatever's on your soup can is fine with me on that top label, right? If you are the best seminar in the world, you're the best seminar in the world. But make sure that it's prepared for and brought to you by your organization. It's all in how you package your organization for those non-genealogists. Your potential in here is it's not alone. It's not apart from other people. Your potential is together and seizing that gap between those current members of your organization and those thousands, if not millions, of customers out there that are waiting to figure out, what do I do beyond that pie chart? You should do that seminar 6 times a year. Make it free. I have my pie chart, now what? It's an hour-long introduction or 45-minute-long introduction to family history that's not called Beginning Your Family History or Beginning Genealogy. Because no one's a beginner because I've already done my DNA. But I want to know what to do with it. Make it free. And then follow up on those leads. The follow-through is key. Make it personal. Have the smiling faces. But remember, it's fun. Right? If someone walks in and tells you that genealogy is going to be this lifelong obsession that's going to cost you a lot of money... Yeah, probably only me and 2 other people are going to say, sign me up, sign me up. That sounds fun. Make it fun. It doesn't have to be everything at once. Make sure that you have a year-long plan for someone that meets your society before they become a member. Marketing specialists say it takes up to 17 times before someone sees something before they actually take action on it. That could be 17 programs, 17 flyers, 17 visits with the mayor, 17 articles in the newspaper before they finally interact with your society. Don't expect immediate results, but also realize that it is a process. It's all about changing our technique and changing our perceptions, because our potential is literally to take all these customers that the MyHeritages and the Ancestries and that have generated and turn them into paying members and paying supporters, because they're already doing the hard work for you. They're getting the idea of family history in someone's head. Take it local and take action on it. And that, I won't say I guarantee, but I pretty much guarantee you'll have success if that's implemented in an exciting way. Take those new customers and figure out how they can become supporters of your society. Members or not, they can be great friends, they can be great advocates, and they truly are our future. So I'll stay around for questions sort of after our last session today, I think, for a little bit. Just food for thought. I know we're at 1:12. Are we good? Oh, good, I didn't go over. But thank you. I can't wait to hear the rest of the afternoon as I sort of prepare my last presentation for you. It's a lot of fun. Thank you.